Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of In Summation, The Final Word, a podcast for inquisitive minds interested in understanding the ins and outs of real-life courtroom drama. I'm your host, Paul Townsend, ready to jump back in history at a case which has been covered over by the sands of time long ago, but really which bears remembering. I cover a decent amount of contemporary cases, cases which are in the news at the time I record and which people watch, at least partially, unfold before their very eyes and are interested to understand why things happen the way that they did. I think the current cases are valuable because they help people see sort of in real time how the discussions and arguments really shape how cases unfold. And people can really process and understand this. The legal industry is not inaccessible for non-lawyers. It sometimes just takes an insider to use plain English and explain what's going on. But as longtime listeners of this show know, I also cover historical cases of some import, cases from the past, which people have heard of, but which had a big impact. We've done Al Capone, Ernesto Miranda, John Brown. It's very interesting to me because I get very different sets of feedback for the current versus the more historical cases. On the current cases, people seem to be more interested in engaging with the arguments. People email me about what each party argued, how the judge ruled on certain issues, and how that shaped the trials. They find these details interesting. On the past cases, people tend to reach out regarding the historical impact the case had, how it created a legacy, how the rules set forth have changed over time, and how they've been applied in ways maybe not foreseen when they were being crafted. I love this. I love that people are taking away different things from the show. That's really what keeps me producing these episodes. So thank you. And please keep the comments flowing. Also, I acknowledge that people have been asking for more guest episodes. I'm working on that and plan to have a few different lawyers with different perspectives on some current cases soon. I've had requests for Elizabeth Holmes, Keith Raniere, and a few others, which are on the list, I promise. Sometimes in the past, there have been criminal trials which captured the nation because of who the defendant or the defendants were, what they stood for, the beliefs they held, or the ideology they pushed for. In this country, we really pride ourselves in the rule of law. More than, I would argue, any other country on earth, the United States has always stood for the proposition that the law should be equally applied to any individual, regardless of wealth or class, race, sexuality, creed, national origin, gender, or whatever else there is. Now, obviously, America has not always lived up to that ideal. We still don't, on a daily basis. The disparities are plain to see. You don't need to be a lawyer to see that not every person experiences the criminal justice system evenly. But that doesn't change the fact that the ideal is still there, and a good number of people working in the legal field really do hold on to it and try to conduct themselves in that fashion. But, of course, racist prosecutions exist. Sexist prosecutions exist. Political prosecutions exist. It's no secret that it's easier to prosecute and convict poor people because they can't afford fancy lawyers who have the ability to devote the time and energy necessary to their cases. And that is no knock on public defenders. I have met a lot of exceptionally good trial lawyers who are public defenders. But the reality is pretty much universal. They have too many cases to direct the time that they would like to each individual case. And when that happens, you simply can't catch everything. It's important to remember those cases where the system fails. This country is at its best when the protections built into the system work to ensure that the rights we profess to grant to all are safeguarded, even for those whose ideas we don't like. It's easy to cheer for those persecuted for beliefs we share. It doesn't take a strong will to protest when the rights of those with whom we agree are violated. But when people stand for things that we don't agree with, ideas which we think are potentially dangerous or destructive, which we think may even threaten our way of life, when people like that are on the business end of a criminal prosecution, that's where we really get tested. Because for the most part, people don't stand up and protest when the rights of those individuals are shredded. People won't march or demonstrate or bring attention when the rules are relaxed to silence those people. But these are cases which test our commitment to the values we profess. These are the situations where we demonstrate exactly how far we are willing to go to live up to the promises made in the Constitution. And yes, sometimes we fail. But it's only when we recognize that we fail that we can reaffirm our push to do better. When we fail and ignore it, we damage the fabric of the system. And even though it's far from perfect, very far from perfect, our system is still better than any other I've seen. That being said, today's case represents one of those failures. It's worth knowing, it's worth remembering, and it's worth studying. It's one of those times where people took a stand against the status quo. They gave speeches which advocated for policies which were countercultural. In this case, the subjects of today's episode were in the process of arguing for an 8-hour workday. That was what led police shootings and a bomb being thrown. The 8-hour workday. Now, don't get me wrong. The men who were put on trial in today's episode were revolutionaries. They held ideas which were really outside the normal political spectrum. But even if they were socialists or anarchists or communists, the fact is that on the particular dates in question, May 3rd and May 4th, 1886, these men gathered together peacefully in Chicago, Illinois, to publicly demand an 8-hour workday. They did not call for violence. They did not advocate for property destruction. They didn't reference the use of force. They argued that an 8-hour workday would benefit both worker and owner. For this, the police were dispatched on May 3rd, 1886, at the conclusion of their demonstration. The police opened fire on the crowd, killing several people. The following day, May 4th, 1886, in Haymarket Square in Chicago, a crowd again formed to protest the brutal police action. Violence again erupted, and a bomb was thrown, which resulted in the death of police officer Matthias Deegan. All told, 10 men were arrested for murdering this officer, though none of them were ever shown to be the bomb thrower. The trial of the Chicago anarchists deserves to be remembered, if for no other reason than to try to ensure that the failings of the system which took place here never happen again. This is the state of Illinois versus the Haymarket Eight. Typically, I like to go through some of the background on the subjects of the episode. I try to give some color as to their background and education, because often that helps people understand certain choices they made or why they held certain beliefs. In this case, there are 8 defendants which ultimately were put on trial together, so we aren't going to go into all of their individual backgrounds. Instead, I like to start by briefly explaining the cultural background of the times. We're in 1886, smack in the middle of the Industrial Revolution. Corporate business owners are getting rich, and the working poor are amassing in cities, angling for factory floor jobs. Those in the lower economic classes are seeing the people who own the companies get fantastically wealthy, as advances in technology are allowing for mass production of goods on a scale never seen before in history. There has always been a socialist movement in America. At certain times, based on societal conditions, it's been more prominent than others, but there have always been people who have advocated for the abolition of private property and felt that government should control the means of production. As you know, this show is not here to take a position on political philosophy. But I will say, in the interest of full disclosure, that my personal opinion on socialism is that it is an economic system which is hopelessly incapable of ever working correctly. For those interested, I would recommend Andrew Heaton's Political Orphans episode on socialism, which I think does a far better job than I ever could of explaining why eliminating a market system in favor of government control of production is destined to always fail. But regardless, socialism tends to gain popularity in time periods of unrest, when people feel as though the current system is treating them unfairly. They gravitate towards new ideas, new systems, which they think will treat everyone more fairly. 1886 was right in the middle of one of those time periods, and some very persuasive, very smart people were enthralled with the idea of socialism or anarchism as an answer to what they perceived as the oppression of capitalism. While August Spies, Albert Parsons, and the other six defendants in the Haymarket bombing trial were avowed socialists, this trial should not really have been about socialism. The defendants here were not charged with being socialists. In Chicago, there's a big factory called the McCormick Harvesting Machine Company. They made agricultural machinery called reapers. In 1886, the average factory worker spent about 60 hours over 6 days at work per week. Trade unions, which were growing in number in big cities, had begun demanding an 8-hour workday. Now, the 8-hour workday had already been signed into law in Illinois on March 2, 1867, by Governor Oglesby. However, big companies felt that the law violated their right to contract with labor free of government interference and largely simply ignored it. And there was virtually no enforcement. Now, it would be manifestly unfair to make sweeping generalizations that trade unions demand X, Y, or Z. Each union is and was individual and unique, and while all unions advocated for the interests of their members, a number of prominent unions were vocally anti-capitalist. They felt that the workers were owed more than wages, since it was the workers' labor which went into making the goods which resulted in the profits the company reaped. Some unions at the time were voting to strike unless the workers were granted a percentage of ownership in the company. Other unions demanded better working conditions. At the McCormick Harvesting Machine Company, the workers wanted an 8-hour workday. And in early May 1886, they decided to go on strike unless the owners of the company met this demand. So what do the leaders of organized labor do when they go on strike? They bring in speakers. They know that strikes hurt everyone. They hurt the workers because they're not working, so they're not getting paid. But they hope that the company itself is getting hurt even more so that the executives and owners will cave first. So labor organizers know that to win this war of attrition, they need to keep the spirits of the striking workers high. So they bring in motivational speakers. And that's where we first meet the main players in our case. The two main people we're going to discuss today are August Spies and Albert Parsons. Spies was a German-born upholsterer by trade, but he spent the bulk of his time as a political agitator. He joined the local wing of the Socialist Labor Party, or SLP, in 1877. But he decided they weren't radical enough for him, so in 1880, he engineered a takeover of the party's executive committee and threw out anyone who was willing to compromise to obtain the party's objectives. Now, this led to a conflict with the national SLP, as they viewed Spies' tactics as distasteful and extreme. Eventually, Spies was kicked out of the SLP and formed his own group, the International Working People's Association. And in addition to his work with the IWPA, Spies became the editor of Arbeiter Zeitung, a socialist newspaper which vocally advocated for a violent end to capitalism. Albert Parsons was also a prominent socialist speaker in the 1870s. He, too, was an editor of a socialist newspaper called The Alarm. Both Parsons and Spies were known to be public speakers who would cheer on the causes of organized labor. Both men were asked to come speak to the striking workers at McCormick. Parsons himself was very devoted to the 8-hour workday cause. For years, he had been loudly pushing for it. Spies also supported the idea, but he felt that it didn't go nearly far enough. Spies' position was that if they were just advocating for an 8-hour workday, then they had already conceded that the structure within which the workers were working was legitimate, and that bothered Spies. But nonetheless, he agreed to come and speak to the crowd and encourage them to hold firm until their demands were met. The strike began on May 1st, May Day, in 1886. Rallies were held, picket lines were set, people demonstrated, and what started as an 80,000-person demonstration marching down Michigan Avenue on May 1st had ballooned to a 340,000-person demonstration by May 3rd. But on May 3rd, the situation changed. The strikes had been peaceful. The workers had kept their cool. There had been speeches, a lot of signs, a lot of chanting, no violence. But McCormick had sought to bring in a skeleton crew of replacement workers to try and resume production during the strike. To organize labor, these people are referred to as scabs. Scabs try to break up a strike by alleviating some of the pressure on the company so that the only people who are actually suffering are the workers, who will then ultimately decide to return to work. On May 3rd, when the bells signaled the end of the workday, the scabs left the factory and were immediately confronted by a group of striking workers. A fight ensued, which quickly became a riot. This was the opening that the Chicago police had apparently been waiting for. 75 uniformed police officers opened fire on the striking workers and killed 6 men before the crowd dispersed and ran away. Take a moment to reflect on this. Workers are on strike seeking an 8-hour workday, which is already mandated by law. They get in a fight with the replacement workers the company has brought in to try and break the strike. And the response by the police department is to line up and open fire on the workers. No warning shots, not rubber bullets, real bullets right into the crowd, 6 men dead. A protest was immediately called for the following day. August Spies and Albert Parsons, among others, were called in and asked to speak to the crowd to denounce the police actions. Both men initially were reluctant, fearing that violence may ensue. Spies would not agree unless the pamphlet to be circulated advertising the rally struck out language which called for people to bring arms. He demanded that it be peaceful or he wouldn't come. Parsons himself only agreed to come when he learned that Spies was coming, knowing that Spies would not publicly advocate for violence under these conditions. Now, in their own respective circles, both men had been known to speak favorably of the use of dynamite as a tool to achieve the necessary ends. But neither would push for it at such a public rally like this, and neither would advocate for its use against people. Ultimately, both men would speak on May 4th, 1886. A crowd of 2,000 or 3,000 had gathered in the evening at Haymarket Square on the near west side of Chicago. Spies spoke first, then Parsons, and then a few others. Both men spoke on the topic of the 8-hour workday, but also expanded outward. They advocated for turning the economic system on its head. They viewed the labor class as wage slaves and the capital-owning class as exploitive looters, refusing to give the common man what is rightfully his. They pushed for the dissolution of private property and turning over of all ownership to the people generally. In this sense, they were pushing for socialist anarchist views. They did not want the government, in the common sense, to control all business, but rather this nebulous idea that the quote-unquote people would have all equal ownership. And thus, the people would each receive their fair reward from the company's profits. Now, whatever you think about this political speech, one thing is very clear from every account of the event. No speaker advocated for violence. No one encouraged harming the police. No one was instructed to riot, to cause property damage, to police government buildings. The speeches were meant to encourage the workers to hold fast during the strike and to protest the actions of the police in killing the six strikers the previous day. Spies in particular specifically noted in his speech that the meeting on May 4th was not called for the purpose of inaugurating a riot, but rather to throw light upon various incidents. As a side note, no adverse action was ever taken against a single police officer for opening fire into the crowd and killing the six men the previous day. After Parsons' speech, the weather began to turn. It appeared a storm was quickly approaching, and a good chunk of the crowd, including the mayor of Chicago at the time, Carter Harrison, decided at that point it was time to leave. This was between 9 and 10 p.m. The speeches had ended at that point, and a few hundred remaining people were milling about but not really doing anything to speak of. After the crowd had thinned considerably, the Chicago Police Department descended upon those that remained. Witness accounts differ on the subject of who opened fire first. At the trial, which we will get to very soon, many individuals were called to testify that the striking workers fired first, and the police only fired back in self-defense. Other eyewitnesses claim that the police fired on the crowd completely unprovoked. He said, it's not entirely clear. What we do know, however, is that police captain William Ward approached the stage before any shots were fired and demanded that the 300 or so remaining people disperse. One of the other defendants, Samuel Fielden, who had been the final speaker and who was still standing near the stage, insisted to Captain Ward that the meeting was peaceful, but agreed that they would leave since all the speakers were done and the weather was now looking bleak. From there, shots ring out, and a homemade bomb is thrown from somewhere in the vicinity of the workers near the stage, and it landed just in front of the line of advancing police officers. Specifically, it landed in front of Officer Matthias J. Deegan, and it was close enough to him that the bomb took his life. In the ensuing fracas, 7 officers total were killed, 60 more wounded in the roughly 5-minute chaos which ensued. Accounts are unclear how many strikers were killed by police bullets. After the explosion of the bomb, pandemonium broke out. Some men were arrested on the spot. Spies and a few others were arrested in the headquarters of their newspaper, Arbeiter Zeitung, while putting their next edition together. Parsons initially left Chicago and stayed with a socialist friend in Wisconsin. And for the weeks following the Haymarket riots, police in Chicago abandoned the oath they took to uphold the law and civil liberties. Without warrants or probable cause, they kicked in doors of known socialists looking for Parsons, often beating up the residents in efforts to gain information. They ransacked houses, destroyed furniture, sent people to the hospital, all in the name of law and order. Parsons ended up voluntarily coming back and marching into court to surrender himself. In all, 10 men were arrested. August Spies, Albert Parsons, Michael Schwab, Adolf Fischer, Samuel Fielden, George Engel, Louis Ling, Oscar Niebe, Rudolf Schnaubelt, and Wilhelm Seliger. That's 10 names. Now, if you'll recall, previously I said 8 defendants were put on trial together. And that's because Seliger pleaded guilty and cooperated with the district attorney, and Rudolf Schnaubelt absconded, fleeing Chicago, never to return, and never to be put on trial. So we focus on the Haymarket Eight. These eight men were charged with murder, conspiracy, and unlawful assembly. There was immense pressure from the public to handle this situation quickly and efficiently. In 1886, socialists, communists, and anarchists, while experiencing swelling ranks, were still largely reviled in American culture. They advocated for essentially the abolition of the American government and scared a good portion of the public. They were avowed revolutionaries, and now they had killed a man they turned into a hero cop. Or had they? More on that in a few moments. First, we have a very detailed account of the jury selection process in this case. This is rare for a case that happened roughly 140 years ago, but I was able to get actual transcripts of the jury selection process. In this country, you have a right to trial by an impartial jury of your peers. That is codified in the Sixth Amendment in the Bill of Rights. It's one of the core principles which upholds our justice system. In the United States, we are not supposed to have show trials. We are not supposed to have kangaroo courts. We aren't supposed to simply go through the motions. An unbiased jury is a necessary component of equality under the law and the fair administration of justice. The word impartial is key here. It's not just a right to trial by jury. It's more than just picking 12 people from your county as opposed to simply having a judge decide your case. Any individual charged with a crime, no matter how serious, no matter how minor, has a right to be tried by people who come into the trial with no bias or pre-made decision about the case. Failing that, the rule of law is reduced to an illusion. The process for selecting a jury is called voir dire. It varies between the federal system and the multiple state systems, but in Illinois, jury summonses are sent randomly to members of the county where the trial is to take place. This satisfies the requirement that the jury comprise peers of the defendant. Those people who receive the summons show up in court and sit in a main gathering room for potential jurors. A section of those jurors, called a panel, is then sent to the individual courtrooms where a judge and the parties are going to be starting a trial. A panel in a big city can be upwards of 80 people. Sometimes more. In a smaller jurisdiction, it may only be 20 to 30. Could be anywhere in between. Those potential jurors show up to the courtroom and then undergo the process of seeing whether they are appropriate jurors for the particular case they are here to listen to. The first thing that happens is the judge will try and weed out any jurors who logistically can't serve. Those who have obligations requiring them to be out of town, who have a medical condition which prohibits them from sitting for long periods of time, those who can't speak and understand English. Once those people are excused, the judge obtains some basic information from the remaining potential jurors: their occupation, their family demographics, maybe the neighborhood they live in, how long they've lived in the county, just basic general information. Then the lawyers will each be given a certain period of time to ask questions of the potential jurors to determine if they satisfy the constitutional requirement of being impartial. The key is whether or not a juror will be able to fairly and impartially hear this particular case, or whether there are certain aspects of either the juror or the case itself which might trigger some bias which the juror would not be able to put aside and which would affect how they judge the outcome. Jurors are told that they must follow the instructions of the judge, even if they disagree with them, and only make their decision based on the evidence received at trial. If a juror cannot do that, for whatever reason, then that juror will be excused for cause. Excused for cause means the juror has a problem with impartiality and cannot sit on the jury. For example, let's say that Laura receives a summons for jury duty. She shows up to the courthouse. She gets put on a panel. She sits down and the attorneys begin the voir dire process. She's a potential juror on a DWI case. The defendant is accused of drunk driving. Let's say that Laura's husband was killed last year by a drunk driver, and now she's become a strong advocate for harsher penalties for DWI cases. The defense lawyer should fully explore this issue and ascertain whether Laura's particular experience with drunk driving might impact how she feels about this particular case. In this case, if Laura's being honest, she'll admit that she has strong feelings on the subject, and it might make it more difficult for her to decide guilt or innocence based on the evidence in this case alone. Another example that comes up frequently deals with drug cases. Many, many people have someone in their life who is either in the throes of addiction or is a recovering addict or who has overdosed, and as a result, they have very strong feelings about drugs and drug dealers. Feelings and emotions that they may not be able to put aside to ensure that a defendant gets a fair trial. Now, let's be very clear about something. Having this bias and being unable to provide a particular defendant with a fair and unbiased trial because of a particular issue in no way makes a potential juror a bad person or immoral or unethical in any way. Our person, Laura, may not be a suitable juror for a DWI case, but she may make a very fair juror in a financial fraud case. Not being picked for a jury is not a character referendum. There is no limit to how many challenges a party can make for cause. If every single juror in the panel showcases some bias, then either party or both parties together can petition the judge to excuse all the jurors for cause. Ultimately, it's up to the judge whether he or she agrees that the juror lacks impartiality. Now, there's a second way that parties can eliminate potential jurors out of the jury pool, the peremptory challenge. If either lawyer is asking questions of a potential juror, and the juror is giving answers indicating that they have no doubt that they can be fair and impartial, but the lawyer just gets a feeling that as soon as that person hits the deliberation room, they are going to be pushing everyone to side against me, they can strike that juror using a peremptory challenge. Typically, you don't need to justify using a peremptory challenge. The only rule is that you cannot use them in a discriminatory way. That means you can't use them to strike every black person off a jury, or every woman, or every person over the age of 70, or every LGBTQ+ person. But other than that, you can strike a juror because you don't like an answer they gave to a question, or you didn't like the way she was looking at the defendant, or you felt she was too hard on crime, or too soft on crime, whatever. The problem is you only get a set number of those. Once you use them all, you're stuck with whoever is left if you cannot get them out for cause. So you have to be strategic about using them. You will get more peremptory challenges the more severe the charges the defendant is facing. In New York, for example, on a murder case, the parties get 20 peremptory challenges. That may sound like a lot, but trust me, they go quickly. It's also important to remember that a trial by impartial jury does not mean that no juror can have heard of the events causing the trial before. Many high-profile cases involve elements very publicly reported on. And just because someone has read news coverage or seen news clips about an incident does not automatically disqualify them as jurors. The key is whether they can set aside what they have read or heard or seen and decide the case exclusively based on the evidence introduced and agree not to make up their minds about guilt or innocence until all of the evidence has been provided for them. If a juror can do that, then it doesn't matter if they have consumed some sort of coverage previously. Okay, back to the Haymarket 8. As you can imagine, the bomb going off was everywhere in the newspapers, nationally. Everyone knew about the strike, the shootings, the bomb, and that the defendants were socialists and anarchists. Jury selection in this case began on June 21, 1886. So the bomb is thrown May 4th, 1886. On May 18th, grand jury is impaneled and is hearing evidence. By May 25th, all 8 men are indicted. Less than 1 month later, the trial begins. The wounds from the bomb are still very fresh, the people of Chicago. A time prohibits us from going into too intricate detail on the jury selection process in this particular case. But as a defense lawyer, I was horrified at the conduct of the court prosecutor, and the administrators. It took 21 days to complete the jury selection process, and quite honestly, it should have taken much longer. The judge overseeing the case, the Honorable Judge Joseph Gary, completely disregarded every request made by the defense lawyers. I'm going to use a few potential jurors here as illustrative of how this entire process went. Clarence Hill was called as a prospective juror. He was asked, "You have no opinions, biases, or prejudices which would require evidence to overcome." His response was, "Yes, sir, I have." He was asked if he had already formed an opinion as to the guilt or innocence of the accused. His response was, "Yes, sir, I have." He was then asked if he was innately prejudiced against socialists, anarchists, and communists. And he responded by saying that he held a deep prejudice against these people. Naturally, the defense challenged Mr. Hill for cause. That was overruled by the judge, and the defense was forced to use a peremptory strike to avoid seating him on the jury. This same situation happened over and over and over again. In Chicago, in 1886, only men were called for jury duty, and the overwhelming majority of those who arrived during those 21 days agreed that they had already formed an opinion as to guilt, and that they were biased against socialists, anarchists, and communists. And on the vast majority of occasions, Judge Gary did not even entertain a for-cause challenge. Another man, James Walker, was questioned as a potential juror. Mr. Walker agreed, upon questioning by defense lawyers, that because of his personal feelings on socialism and anarchism, that his judgment would be handicapped. The following is a direct quote from Judge Gary after hearing this. "Well, that is a sufficient qualification for a juror in the case. Of course, the more a man feels that he is handicapped, the more he will be guarded against it." So Judge Gary's official stated position on the record, transcribed for all time while sitting on the bench, was that the more biased a potential juror was, the better a juror he would be because he was aware of his bias. Wow. I reviewed the voir dire for all 12 of the jurors who were picked. Of the 12, 9 of them indicated that their personal biases would affect how they would determine the case. 10 of them said that they held specific personal biases against socialists, anarchists, and communists. And 9 of them said that they had already formed an opinion of guilt or innocence. This is not surprising when you consider that the bailiff overseeing this case, Otis Favor, did not send the jury summonses out randomly, as he was supposed to do. He was documented in an affidavit as saying, "I am managing this case and I know what I am about. Those fellows will hang as certain as death. I am summoning as jurors such men as they will be compelled to challenge peremptorily. And when they have exhausted their peremptory challenges, they will have to take such jurors as are satisfactory to the state." Otis Favor had summoned mercantilists, bankers, executives, and other wealthy and well-to-do individuals who would have had absolutely no sympathy for socialist revolutionaries, men who had a lot to lose if the economic structure was brought down. Even when a sworn affidavit was provided by the individual who Favor had made that statement to, and was unrefuted by Favor himself, Judge Gary refused to hold a hearing on whether Favor had acted inappropriately. The lead prosecutor on the case was a man named Julius Grinnell, who towards the end of jury selection, seeing the defense had run out of peremptory challenges, didn't even bother to try and get potential jurors to say they could be fair and impartial at the end of the day, because he knew it didn't matter. William Black, a former captain in the Union Army during the Civil War, was the defense lawyer for all 8 defendants. The witnesses called by Grinnell were inconsistent at best. A few of the labor leaders had capitulated and cooperated with Grinnell. but in a non-sensational case, their testimony really would not have been all that helpful. Gottfried Waller, who chaired the anarchist meeting on the night of May 3rd, after the strikers were killed by the police, which they discussed how to respond and what to do, testified for the prosecution. But his testimony was that they planned to hold a rally, that at no point in the meeting did anyone ever mention dynamite, and that spies had said they didn't even expect the police to intervene, so there was no need to discuss arms or violence at all. Waller did testify that on a completely separate faction of the 8-hour workday group, who operated on the northwest side of Chicago, was planning to throw bombs in police stations if the police took violent action against the May 4th rally. None of the men arrested were affiliated with that group, nor were any members of that particular group arrested. Bernard Schrade testified next. His only real contribution was that he contradicted Waller's testimony as to how many people were at the May 3rd meeting. Schrade was asked on direct examination whether he himself had any bombs. The defense objected to the question on the grounds that whether a witness ever had a bomb did not really have any bearing on whether any of the defendants did. I bring up this particular detail and question because the prosecutor's response is really instructive on the overall theory of this case. Grinnell's second chair, Mr. Ingram, addressed the court in response. He said the state's theory of the case was that the defendants had, for 2 or 3 years, been engaged in a gigantic conspiracy against law and order itself, and the Monday, May 3rd meeting was just one example of that, that Schrade was part of this conspiracy, and thus if Schrade had the bombs, then they had the bombs too. Ingram and Grinnell had no idea who threw the bomb, which these men were all on trial for throwing. They called one witness, Mr. Gilmer, who they asked about the bomb, and who stood up out of the witness chair, pointed directly at August Spies, and said he was the one who threw it. The courtroom erupted, and it took Judge Gary several minutes to quiet everyone down. It's really a spectacle. The problem with this testimony is that it had been conclusively established that August Spies was not anywhere near the stage at the time the bomb was thrown, and not anywhere in the vicinity of the bomb's origination point. It was simply not feasible, and thus the testimony was not credible. There were a few other exciting moments of the trial. At one point, Grinnell handed the jurors a sampling of bombs, which was noted on the record to cause several of the jurors extreme anxiety. Mostly, however, from what I could tell, Grinnell and his team made this trial extremely boring. Much of the prosecution's case consisted of introducing a bunch of socialist and anarchist newspapers and then reading them. So many pamphlets and papers were introduced that they couldn't even keep them all on the evidence table, and they began to cover the floor of the courtroom. But the trial itself, reading through the transcripts, was definitely missing something. There were a bunch of pamphlets and newspapers, many of which were just socialist and anarchist papers, not related to these specific defendants at all. Some advocated for the violent overthrow of the government, many were critical of the police and justice system. But what does that have to do with murder? Witnesses testified that Spies, Parsons, and the rest were socialists, that they had previously criticized the police and called for violent protest in papers they edited, but no witnesses were able to testify that any such intention was present at Haymarket. To the contrary, even the prosecution witnesses testified that during the meeting which took place the night before, Spies addressed the question of what to do about the police by simply saying he didn't expect any intervention, so there was nothing to discuss. No witness testified that any member of the conspiracy had talked about dynamite or bombs, had discussed killing any police officer, had even agreed to respond to the police with violence if they were treated with violence of any kind. Let's talk for a minute about murder. What does a prosecutor have to prove to earn a conviction for murder, generally speaking? We'll look at it in the most global sense, since the Haymarket Eight were charged with the substantive crime of murder, as well as the crime of conspiracy generally. To convict on the substantive crime of murder, it has to be shown that either the individual intentionally caused the death of another person without any legal justification, or that the defendant was an accomplice who either aided in bringing about the intended result, or who was participating in a felony under circumstances which were known to the defendant and which were reasonably likely to cause a non-participant in the crime to be killed, and that that person was in fact killed. So there's three ways. The first is standard murder, intentionally causing the death of another without justification. The second is accomplice liability. You didn't pull the trigger yourself, but you supplied the gun, or the bomb, with the express intention that it be used to cause the death of another. The third is felony murder. If you're involved in the commission of a felony, say a gunpoint robbery, and your co-defendant shoots the robbery victim and kills him, you're responsible for that murder. One quick note about transferred intent. To be convicted of murder, you do not necessarily have to cause the death of the person that you are trying to cause the death of. Based on the legal theory of transferred intent, if you intend to kill one person but end up killing a different person, the intent to cause the death of the second person is established. Think of it as the drive-by shooting rule. If a person is engaged in a drive-by shooting, spraying bullets at their intended target, and some of those bullets miss the target, go into a house, and hit someone in the house, killing them, the shooter is guilty of murdering that person, even though he or she had no intention of killing the person in the house. They intended to kill the person on the street. So if someone throws a bomb intending to kill one police officer, but it lands close to other officers and kills them instead, well, that's still murder. So, did any of these three theories of murder apply to the Haymarket Eight based on the evidence that was produced at the trial? If we discount the one witness who very excitedly jumped out of his chair and proclaimed to the courtroom that he had personally seen August spies throw the bomb, despite spies having been demonstrably incapable of doing so from the location of origin, the answer realistically is no. There was no testimony that anyone intended to kill anyone. That is legally insufficient to supply intent for murder presently. No credible evidence put the bomb in anyone's hand. Nobody seems to have actually seen who threw the bomb, which killed Officer Deegan. So none of the eight fit the bill for principal liability for intentional murder. They are not actually observed directly causing Officer Deegan's death. Let's jump quickly to felony murder. I don't think this holds up either. I've gone back and forth with some friends on this and talking through the case with them, and here's my thought. To convict them for felony murder, they have to be actively participating in a felony at the time of the death. They had recently finished a peaceful rally when the police descended upon them. Let's say, for the sake of argument, one of the workers fired the first shot at the police, thus constituting a felony. And the bomb is thrown and someone dies. Does that make it felony murder? I say no. Because in order to convict for felony murder, the defendant has to know that it's reasonably likely under the circumstances for a co-participant in the crime to cause a death. For example, if three guys with guns go and rob a bank, all three know that each is carrying a gun and that guns can easily cause death. And they're engaging in a felony, which could very possibly result in a gunfight. If one of the robbers shoots someone, they are all likely guilty of felony murder. But now let's say the three guys are going to go rob a bank. They all agree beforehand, no weapons, just fingers in jacket pockets simulating a gun. Nobody is supposed to get hurt. Two guys go to the bank unarmed, sticking to the plan. But the third guy decides the plan might not work, decides to bring a gun. He shoots a bank teller. The other two robbers can be convicted of bank robbery, but should probably be acquitted of felony murder, because under the circumstances they expected, the third robber should not have killed anyone or even had the ability to kill anyone in that way. So here, absent critical testimony about what the Haymarket Eight knew was reasonably likely to happen on May 4th, 1886 at that rally, I think felony murder doesn't really fit. testimony concerning the reaction to the police was to disregard it as something that wasn't going to be an issue. And other testimony very clearly established that spies and Parsons did not intend to engage in violence. So if the theory is that these men were leaders and they were anticipating a peaceful rally, it is not reasonable to convict them of felony murder for what one of the workers does that they had no idea was going to happen. So finally, what about accomplice liability? None of the witnesses provided any testimony that any of the Haymarket Eight discussed, planned, agreed, or wanted to harm or kill anyone at the May 4th, 1886 rally. The most they could offer were general statements made in the past that when the police attack us, we have a duty to fight back in kind. There was no evidence offered that they actively supported killing anyone there. Most of the evidence from the prosecution witnesses was actually quite to the contrary. These men were revolutionaries. They were advocating for change. Yes, in their respective newspapers and pamphlets and in their public speeches that they had made previously, they pushed for changes in ways that would be uncomfortable for the common man. Sometimes they did call for violence. Sometimes they would say that the only thing the capitalists understand is a bomb. But these men were not put on trial for putting out a pamphlet in 1885 saying that extremism in the name of socialism is acceptable to overthrow the wage slave system. They weren't put on trial for stating in past speeches that when cops attack us, we have to shoot back. They're put on trial for this particular act, this particular death on this particular date. The things they have said and done in the past cannot and do not establish their actions on May 4th, 1886. All they do is try and show the jury that these men are dangerous and criminal-minded. In our system of justice, we don't convict people simply because they've done bad things or even criminal things in the past. And we especially do not convict people for engaging in their right to free speech simply because the things they're advocating for are things we disagree with. That's why it was so important to get a jury pool of people who were biased against anarchists and socialists, because this was an exceptionally weak case. The goal here was not to prosecute eight individuals for causing the death of a police officer. It was to silence what was perceived to be a dangerous and growing movement which threatened capitalism. And while I am a staunch defender of capitalism, the use of the justice system to persecute its insurgents is a scourge. Grinnell's case lasted 40 days. And on the 40th day, the prosecution rested, and the defense had the opportunity to present their case. The defense was clear. Anarchy is not on trial. Socialism was not on trial. These were red herrings designed to inflame the jurors and invoke anger towards the defendants. Captain Black argued in his opening statement that the prosecution's case was built on shaky information at best. Several of the Haymarket Eight were not even at the rally on May 4th. Some were in a pub, others were at home. Those who claimed to be eyewitnesses were all being paid handsomely by the police department for their testimony. The first defense witness was Chicago Mayor Carter Harrison, who testified that he was made aware of the rally on the morning of May 4th. He instructed the chief of police only to intervene if it became clear that the rally was going to turn into a riot. Then he decided that he wanted to go himself and see whether this rally was really going to be peaceful. He testified that he listened to spies and to Parsons, that he found nothing objectionable from an assembly perspective. It was clear that the meeting was ending, nothing unruly had happened, the weather was turning bad, so he decided to leave. And at the time of his departure, nobody at the rally had done anything illegal. He further testified that he told the police captain there that it seemed no interference was necessary. Shortly after he left, the police descended upon the crowd. Following the mayor, several defense witnesses testified that the police shot first, and many testified that only the police shot, that no workers discharged any firearms. meaning that aside from the bomb, the other officers killed were likely killed by friendly fire. Many more testified that during the speeches, the speakers attempted to prevent violence rather than incite it. While Spies was speaking, somebody from the rally shouted that they should hang a prominent business owner, and Spies immediately told him that he did not understand what they were trying to do if he wanted to hang this man. He said they didn't want to harm individuals. They wanted to harm the system. During the closing arguments for the defense, second chair attorney Sigmund Ziesler blamed the police, claiming friendly fire had claimed most of the police deaths that none of the Haymarket Eight had any knowledge of or anything to do with the bomb throwing. The defense further argued that Albert Parsons would not have brought his wife and children to the Haymarket rally if he knew that bombs were going to be thrown at police officers there. Captain Black concluded the defense summation by quoting Jesus, who he described as a divine socialist, saying, "As ye would that others should do to you, do even so to them." The prosecutors, Julius Grinnell, Francis Walker, and George Ingram, claimed that these eight men were part of a vast labor conspiracy. This conspiracy intended to kill to achieve its goals. They presented the case as a choice between anarchy and order, whether government could survive. Grinnell claimed that if the defendants were acquitted, that militant anarchists would flood the streets like rats and vermin. The rhetoric from the prosecution's closing arguments is beyond just disturbing. It isn't just shameful. As a former prosecutor myself, I find it horrifying. Grinnell made no attempt to hide that the evidence in this case really didn't support a conviction, but to acquit these men would be a step towards socialism. And so, it was these men's duty as Americans to convict the Haymarket Eight of murder simply because not doing so would tear down the fabric of American society. The government, it was argued, needed the jury to put aside proof beyond a reasonable doubt, put aside innocent until proven guilty, put aside critical reasoning skills, and just convict these men because they don't believe in capitalism. And that's what they did. On August 19, 1886, after deliberating for nothing more than a few short hours, the jury convicted all eight. Seven of the men were sentenced to death, with only Oscar Niebe getting a determinate jail sentence of 15 years. All appeals were swiftly denied. Even a last-ditch effort, which obtained 100,000 signatures requesting clemency, was ignored. It wasn't until the head of the Chicago Bar Association, a former U.S. senator from Illinois, and some other civic leaders in Chicago urged Governor Oglesby to grant clemency that he actually took notice. Even then, all he did was reduce the sentences of Fielden and Schwab to life in prison. The rest, he kept the death penalty intact. On November 10th, 1887, Louis Ling committed suicide while in jail by placing a stick of dynamite in his mouth and lighting it. The following day, November 11th, 1887, the four remaining men sentenced to death, Spies, Parsons, Engel, and Fisher, were hanged. In summation, there have been times in this country's history when prosecutions haven't been conducted in good faith. When prosecutors and courts have singled out people, targeted them, not for criminal conduct, but for offensive principles, sought to punish them. There's no question this is wrong each and every time it happens, whether it's because someone is an avowed socialist, anarchist, civil rights activist, gay rights activist, whoever. We as a society are supposed to stand for the position that you have a right to speak out against the status quo, to buck trends, to push for changes you think will improve things. You have a right not to go to jail for your ideas. That's free speech. That's free expression. My stance on the First Amendment protections is well documented through previous episodes, so I won't go on any long rants here. But suffice it to say that the prosecution of the Haymarket Eight was a complete and utter disgrace, top to bottom. There was no credible evidence that any of these men were in any way involved with the crimes that they were charged with. They were rounded up in a usual suspect-style dragnet because law enforcement viewed the Haymarket riot as an excuse to go after labor leaders and silence them. Anytime the court system fails on this level, there's a chilling effect that ripples through. We will never know how many people saw what happened in Chicago in the spring of 1886 and decided that expressing their two thoughts simply wasn't worth the risk. Alternatively, what is the message that this whole situation sends? The content of the speeches being made in support of the strike was that the system is oppressive and we need to completely change it because the rich and powerful are dead set on keeping the workers down and repressing them at every turn. There is no justice. There is no fairness. It's exploitative and cruel. And how does the government respond to this message? By opening fire on a crowd, then rounding up people and charging them with murder without a shred of actually believable evidence they had anything to do with the death of a police officer, making the trial solely about their political affiliation rather than Officer Deegan, and then executing these men. Just my opinion, but rather than shut down the socialist movement, it seems more like the city of Chicago was doing everything it could to prove the workers' point. The police and court system were acting oppressively. There was no justice, no fairness, and it turned the Haymarket Eight into martyrs. I've said this before in past episodes as well. Our court system is judged by how we treat the most despised defendants we have, the cartel leaders, the socialist revolutionaries, even the Donald Trumps. In this case, we see firsthand how unscrupulous men can pervert the court system to commit the state-sanctioned killing of political enemies. Let's all commit to keeping our eyes and ears open and call out this type of corruption in the courts when we see it. So that's the story of the Haymarket Eight. Eight men condemned to death for having the temerity to publicly advocate for socialist anarchism. Thank you to Dan Townsend, who edited today's episode. And a special thank you to Mac Browder, who requested that I look into the trial of the Chicago anarchists and do an episode on it. If you want to get in touch with me to suggest a topic or a case, if you want to ask a question about criminal law, or you just want to send me a message unrelated to the show, please email me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at insummationpod. I'm on Instagram at insummation. You can visit the show's website, insummation.com, check out the show's Facebook page, or you can look me up on my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. As always, I appreciate the thoughtful messages I get and the discussions they generate. If you disagree with me, you're always free to let me know what you think and why. And who knows, maybe you'll change my mind. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the show. And if you rate and review it, it'll help other people find it as well. If you're new, please check out the entire catalog. As always, thanks for stopping by, and I hope that you'll come back for more.